Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, so I got some Mariners roster news and then a look back at some of the heroes, the key players of the weekend. You, Curtis, and I had talked about the players facing the biggest pressure without Mitch Haniger, so we're going to check and see how they did in the series. Before that, though, some Mariners roster moves. Now, there are some vaccine protocols for this series against Toronto that was going to limit potentially some players on the roster. If you're an unvaccinated player, you wouldn't be able to travel with the team into Toronto and play this series. So we're wondering how that would affect the lineup. It looks, though, like you're just going to be short right now, just one reliever. Drew Steckenrider placed on the restricted list. Roenis Elias selected from AAA Tacoma. Otherwise, unless there are other roster moves waiting to be made, you can assume that the rest of the lineup will remain the same with, you know, JP, Ty, Julio, all the guys that you would expect to be there being there. Mm-hmm. And then Steck being a reliever, not with your club. But otherwise, looks like much of the same roster. So ended up being less impactful than we worried.
Yeah, but you know the thing is that you hope that this doesn't come back to hurt you in terms of your bullpen, because this bullpen is already on shaky ground, right? It's already, you know, been devastated with injury and having, you know, a ton of fluctuation already to start the season. Now you won't have Drew Steckenrider, who, although has not gotten off to a great start this season, still is one of the mainstays in your bullpen. So now you're going to have Roenis Elias, who, you know, everyone has been excited about, you know, and wanting to see for quite some time to come up with the big league club. So we'll see what Elias is able to do, or if he gets opportunities to contribute during this 3-game stretch. But, you know, that is the one downside. I was honestly wondering if there was going to be more players than just this. Certainly if you're looking at this from a positive perspective, that there isn't a whole lot of movement to your lineup or to your starting rotation or anything else that would really throw a major wrench into your ability to win games. But you hope that ultimately it does not come down to, gosh, you wish Drew Steckenrider was in this bullpen that you could go to and it ends up costing you a game. But obviously excited to see what Roenis Elias could do. He's very talented.
Now, it's not going to be easy by any means. Like, you already are going to deal with a difficult roster. We mentioned it when we were talking with Shannon, a Toronto roster that got better in the offseason as well with some key additions. Your pitching probables, you got Chris Flexen for this one. You're also going to see Gilbert in the series. And was it Gonzalez, I think, is day three in this one? Your pitching probables for the weekend. Flexen has not had a ton of run support behind him.
No,
the offense took off yesterday, finished with 16 hits. All great news. You got 8 runs. Everything's great.
Yeah.
Can you repeat it against another very tough team? This road trip is not an easy one.
No, it's not. And you got through. You're very fortunate to win these last three, right? I mean, the last, you know, 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
Against the Mets. I mean, that was a huge win for them. And, you know, I'm hoping that they can obviously do the same thing against Toronto, but it's going to be a tough deal. And it's a different type of matchup, I believe, Stacy. And yes, the Mets have a great lineup that's been mashing and all that, but Toronto, I think, is a different offensive beast. I mean, they've got guys that really, really are star level players that if you aren't disciplined, Flexen, Gilbert, and Gonzalez, if you aren't disciplined with your outings, they are really, really going to make you pay. And that's the thing that I'm going to be curious to see about. And starting off today on Monday, you have Kikuchi, who, you know, obviously we know how talented he is and what he can look like at his best. He can be an all-star level pitcher, but at his worst, he is somebody that really can struggle with command and also getting out of jams. And so if the Mariners can put, you know, traffic on base and can be really disciplined at the plate and really force Kikuchi to throw strikes, it gives them an opportunity to win. And hopefully they can build off the momentum of this last series win against the Mets and get things going again against Kikuchi. So that's kind of what I'm looking for and I'm hoping happens, but we'll see.
Sidebar, speaking of the Mets, what did you guys make of Jesse Winker and the other outfielders waving Mets fans goodbye after leaving, kind of like a mockery of Mets fans as they were leaving? Because I think there were some people that were like, what are you doing? You're a losing club.
Yeah.
This is tacky. I thought it was amazing. I want to play the Mets every single week.
Why did you think it was amazing?
Because I love attitude. Because I think that I want a club that is this young to be a club that is hungry. And a club that is hungry is often a club that is confident. And a club that is confident is one that can be cocky and sometimes arrogant. And not arrogant to the point of overlooking areas where it must improve. But to get attitude, I want attitude. I want a club that's fun. And to me, that's fun for me. It wasn't mean. And you aren't like a 3-win team. And even if you were a 3-win club, I would still love to see them do it. Because give it back. Because you know why? The best fans of the best clubs usually do stuff like that. You want to know why Red Sox fans are so annoying to so many people? Because they are diehard fans.
Yes.
And I love the idea of a club being so brash. Well, and their fans.
And, you know, the Mets being such a passionate fan base, right? And as Shannon said, like, hadn't seen a May environment like that in quite some time.
That was a blast.
It was really fun. But also to see that the Mariners rose to that occasion and embraced it and loved it. I mean, let's go to cut number 7 here, Brady, and Winker talking about his relationship with Mets fans and enjoying the back and forth.
I'm going to be honest with you. I love them. They are an amazing group of people. They are very passionate about their team and their city. And from a guy who, born in upstate New York, big fan of that football team up there, I can understand the passion. I respect it. And this thing we got going on is special. Like I said, they're fun.
So I think Jesse Winker looking at it and saying, look, I'm from this area. I know how these fans are. I know how they work. And you know what? The best part about it is I'm going to have fun with it because they love it too. Like, as much as Mets fans will be like, ah, that Jesse Winker, that Paul Sewald for, you know, talking about how they gave up on him, they love the back and forth. They live for the back and forth. And it is a game. It is a show. And Jesse Winker, being like a WWE star, playing the heel role and loving it because he knows that there is that relationship there. And I agree with you, Stacey, is, look, even if this group has been struggling, Jesse Winker been struggling, to have the confidence and to love the game and to still find moments to enjoy the game like this actually gets me very excited. It makes me hopeful that they can turn this thing around, that even at their down points, that they still feel very confident in who they are, what they can be, what they can produce on the field, and that they believe that they are still that type of team and that type of player. To me, there's nothing but positives to take away from that. And so I love that more so than a team that's like, hey, we were lucky to walk away from this series, you know, winning 2 out of 3, and we should just be grateful for that. No, they belong. They're supposed to be there. And this is the expectation that they had when they started the season, and they're not going to back down from anybody. I love it.
I mentioned looking back at a few top performers from the weekend. I didn't mean that as in like, oh, Julio Rodriguez was 4 for 4. What I meant was you, Curtis, and I looked at who's going to have the most pressure now that Mitch Haniger's out of the lineup. Who doesn't fall on? The three of us and Shannon, who we had on as a guest that day, had 4 different names. I said Ty France, to which Shannon replied, no, like the least of it. What else can Ty do? Baseball harder? He's already he's the best hitter on the team. What are you going to do?
But
Ty, we need more hits
but
from
I
you.
Think, but I think for but, to your point,
thank you.
Right, to your point is like, look, Ty is your JP and Ty are your stars right now.
Thank you.
They are the guys that you are relying on. And yeah, your job, you're already doing your job really well. But unfortunately, you might have to do even more with what you're being asked to do because the pressure to produce any runs kind of falls on you. And so I understood what you were saying in that, and I get where Shannon's coming from, too.
She got where I was coming from, giving me a hard time. Her answer was A. Eugenio Suarez, which is a great answer, and she gave her reasoning for that. You said Jesse Winker, so we'll pause there before we get to Curtis's. But you said Jesse Winker. Jesse Winker has improved. He hasn't had the start to the season, and even during this series, he had great moments and then moments where it's like, oof.
Yeah.
Not so great, but I mean, he delivered, at least when it came to the home run. And, I mean, like we just talked about, kind of some of that attitude.
Oh, 100%. But, the thing that's going on with Jesse Winker that is quietly happening is he is on a 7-game hit streak. And you know, this was a tweet from Daniel Kramer, who we'll have on in less than an hour coming up at 1 o'clock. Excited to talk to him and break down the Mariners and what he's seeing from them. But he's on a 7-game hit streak after, you know, during the stretch, he's batting, you know, .333 and has an OPS of almost .850. So
which,
you talk
by the way,
about
is second on the team in, well, it's .959 over the last seven, second on the team in OPS over the last week.
Right. So when you talk about that stretch and you talk about this change for Jesse Winker, this is what I was talking about. This is the type of performance that you need to have out of Jesse Winker in order to be able to compete, in order to be able to, you know, move on from Mitch Haniger's absence. And this is the bat, Stacey. This is the bat that was supposed to make this lineup deep. This was the bat that was supposed to take them over the top. It, you know, in respect to Shannon's answer, and I get why she said it, because he is the home run masher. He can drive in runs and change a game just like that. But Jesse Winker was brought in as that, oh man, this is the, you know, golden aspect of this deal, and he's the guy that's going to help, in conjunction with everyone else, make this a playoff team. And so far, he obviously has not lived up to that. It's been a rough start for him. But now you're seeing him over the last seven games start to take a turn here in a positive direction. And if he can continue to do so on this road trip, it makes a big difference for this team. And that's why I think that you're looking at this group playing a way more competitive brand of baseball, and also being able to walk away out of New York with 2 out of 3 wins. I mean, Jesse Winker is a big part of that.
All right, Monday, May 23rd is the Title IX 50th anniversary celebration at T-Mobile. The Mariners are celebrating with a ticket special, and that ticket gives you access to a pregame panel hosted by Root Sports' Angie Mentink, one of our absolute favorites. Then you can watch the M's take on the A's with a 6:40 p.m. first pitch. Find tickets at mariners.com/Title IX. It's Title IX, Roman numeral 9, Title IX. All right, let's get to headline rewrites.
Extra, read all about it.
Headline Rewrites.
Presented by Tila Mortgage.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Jake and Stacey.
All right, the number one seed Phoenix Suns were knocked out of the playoffs in embarrassing fashion with a stunning blowout loss to the Dallas Mavericks. What's the real headline?
The Suns had one of the most epic collapses. In the biggest moment on the biggest stage, which is something Seahawks fans can't relate to. It sounds really awful.
No, not at all.
I feel for you. I can't imagine how it feels, but I mean, that's a bummer. I mean, I can't relate, but that is a bummer for you guys.
Maybe you've been able to erase it from your mind. You just don't want to remember.
Erase what?
I don't know how to tell you this, but the Seahawks had an epic collapse in Super Bowl 49. And
Jake, we didn't have Super Bowl 49. Oh. It went from 48 to 50. Everyone knows this.
Okay.
Everyone knows that. It's a weird kind of superstitious like thing that
it's like a leap year.
NFL did. It's exactly like that. Like okay. How 13 is an unlucky number. They say the same thing that many people say that about 49. So the NFL just skipped right over it.
Okay. So I will allow you to continue to do that.
Thank
because
you.
I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to go down that road. But honestly, what I was surprised, I thought you were going to say, was that the Kardashian curse lives on. I mean, Devin...
Technically, Kendall's a Jenner, but...
Is that true? So is that why the Kardashian curse doesn't live on? I mean, it's part of the Kardashian crew.
Technically part of the Kardashian crew, but Devin Booker dating one of the Kardashians, technically Kendall Jenner. She's...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But. So I thought that was going to be the route that you went here, but I just cannot believe, Stacey, that... Look... Congratulations to the Dallas Mavericks being able to pull off this upset series win. But the Suns, let's be honest, epic collapse. Epic collapse. And this is a team that has been fun, has been exciting to watch all season long. You had a MVP candidate in Devin Booker who falls flat on his face. Chris Paul, who, you know, has had, you know, back-to-back chances now of helping this team be the number one seed in the Western Conference and not be able to, you know, capitalize on trying to win a championship. I mean, it's amazing to see such a talented team fall apart, but I think it also goes to speak to, you could look at Chris Paul, remove him out of the situation, the overall lack of maturity or lack of being able to step up in a big game in a big moment that you witness from this group. And I'll be curious as to the long-term success of the Suns. Are they going to be able to get over this? That's what I'm going to be curious about.
Headline Rewrites.
The Reds lost after pitching a no-hitter. Come on, man. What's the real headline?
It was a phenomenal pitching performance supported by zero offense, which here in Seattle we call a Felix.
Stacey,
not Felix toward the end of his career, but...
Definitely not towards the end of his career, but...
Toward the prime?
Oh,
absolutely.
Man, it was painful.
Think of how many great players have come through the Mariners organization with no
I don't want to show for it.
I want you to think about
no,
it.
No, I don't want to.
I want you to skip about it.
Stacey, you wanted to skip over Super Bowl 49.
It doesn't... What Super Bowl 49?
Why do you want me to have to suffer through this part, right? Why are you making me think through this? I want to skip over all of those
years. Asking me to think about something that doesn't exist.
Okay. I feel for Reds fans... hardcore right now. Like, it just is so bad from an organizational standpoint. You know that your organization does not care about winning at all. And also that the product that is out there on the field is a beyond a tough watch.
Horrific.
I mean, you have a bright, shining moment, a youngster go out there and dominate and pitch a no-hitter, and it gets completely wasted. You lose often. You didn't give up a single hit and you lost. It's just like, if you thought it couldn't get any worse, it does.
Brady, would you explain how that game was won by Pittsburgh despite not registering a hit?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So pretty much Hunter Green went 7 1/3 inning. In that eighth inning, he gave up two walks. At 118 pitches, they're like, all right, gotta take him out. Art Warren comes in to pitch. He gives up a walk. Bases loaded. One out. Ground ball to second base. Sure, inning-ending double play. Second baseman bobbles the ball. They're only able to get the out at second, not at first. And the runner from third scores. So, therefore, no hit recorded, but a run still counts.
Boy.
Gross.
I mean...
I hate it. Thanks.
It hurts.
I hate it.
It hurts. And we're not Reds fans, but I feel for them so much.
I feel for any organization where the people at the very top are not willing to. It's almost like they're holding a team hostage.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds dramatic, and I say it to mean that you would hope that any owner wants to win as badly as fans do. And I understand that owners are in it for the business as well. It is a business to them, just like it's a business to players. There are different incentives and motives for people, and I understand that. But telling fans, as the president of the team did, telling fans, you know, like, or what?
Yes.
Where are you going to go? What team are you going to watch? We'll move it.
Yeah, be grateful.
Yeah, be grateful for what you have. And it's like, it's just so disrespectful. It's got this, like, it's got like a tinge of kind of this weird, like, 1%-y kind of, like, you know, deal with it, peasants.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Deal with my ball club.
I got one more funny thought for you guys to think about here. Yes. You know when a team throws a perfect game or a no-hitter, everyone charges the mound, like, they're dogpiling, they're happy.
Right.
Just imagine the Cincinnati Reds not giving up a hit, technically throwing a no-hitter, and then the camera has that as a subtitle on it, but they're panning as the players are picking up their stuff and walking down the tunnel because they actually lost the game.
That's brutal.
It's horrible.
Yeah, absolutely brutal.
Oh. Headline rewrites.
All right. Julio Rodriguez has a four-hit day for the Mariners. What's the real headline?
A young star delivering on a team promise. Now, these are actually related. I'm glad that these headlines are back-to-back because we talked about a team being in the business of winning, and sometimes teams are in the business of business. And I know that that's a fear that so many Mariners fans have, right?
Yeah.
You missed the playoffs for 20 years, people are going to wonder whether you want it as much as they do. That's a natural human reaction. And I think that Seattle and the front office being so excited about some of these young guys, those guys not working out feels like an even bigger punch in the gut to people. And I think it's too early to say, for instance, that Kelnick won't work out. I know he was just sent down to Tacoma, but again, he's very young. I think it's too early to say anything. The fact that Julio is looking phenomenal, every Julio hit means something to Mariners fans.
Like, it does.
Just the hunger that you have to get back to the postseason and the belief that you want to have in something and you want to believe what someone's telling you.
Correct.
A rookie getting a hit maybe shouldn't mean that much, but it does.
It does.
And so him getting four of them, that had to feel great.
No, absolutely. Watching him have his best game of his young career was fantastic. And not only seeing him do that, but do it in the environment that it was in New York against the Mets, against the best team in the NL, Yeah, that was pretty sweet to watch, Stacey. I mean, in the big shining moment, Julio Rodriguez stepped up to the plate and knocked it out of the park, right? I mean, figuratively and literally. And I believe that when you're looking at Julio Rodriguez, the reason why you're hanging on every at-bat like you were with Kelnick and like you are with Logan Gilbert and George Kirby and everybody else is because you do have that hunger to be there, to be that much closer. And when Julio Rodriguez shows that he is a star and that can't, and that he has superstar written all over him and he's showing that on the field, you know what that does? Is it forces your organization to actually make aggressive moves. Just like 2021 was supposed to be that offseason that springboards this organization into, you know, progressing towards becoming a playoff contender, it's still a long season and we'll see how this plays out, but you're, every time Julio Rodriguez gets a hit, every time Julio Rodriguez has a performance like he just had, it puts more pressure on the organization, or it allows the organization to feel confident in putting more chips in to, you know, really going for it in terms of, you know, a playoff hunt and being in contention and being that much closer to feeling like you have the pieces necessary to be able to be not just a playoff contender, but long-term,
yeah,
a World Series contender. And that's why I think when you watch Julio Rodriguez have the success he's having, you enjoy it just a little bit more than usual.
You know, looking back in that first headline with the Suns being knocked out of the playoffs in Game 7 and such an embarrassing blowout loss despite being the most dominant team in the regular season, are there other collapses that you can think of? I mean, as far as playoff NBA collapses, I mean, Golden State,
yeah,
Cavs,
that was
a major one.
Big time, big time.
But,
the Atlanta Falcons, the New England Patriots Super Bowl.
28-3 or like, you know.
Yeah.
If it just becomes a meme, a thing in itself, that's a pretty epic collapse.
There's also one, the Indians-Cubs World Series.
Yeah, that is true,
3-1
too.
3-1 lead.
Yep. It's very true. I mean, those are moments that, you know, when teams are able to pull off the improbable, you remember those moments because of how emotional and how crazy it was. But oftentimes you forget about the team that lost.
Yeah.
And what that meant to that franchise and to those players and the domino effect that it ended up having. I mean, look at the Atlanta Falcons. You talked about 28-3. That was a franchise that was on the up and up.
You're the Matty best offense Ice in the league.
Yes. And then they fall flat on their face, collapse. And they're never able to really be that playoff team again. I mean, it just, they can have devastating effects on any given franchise.
Well, speaking of the NFC South, Drew Brees, former Saints quarterback, has retired from the booth, but also maybe not. And he's retired from football, but also maybe not. I'll explain next.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studio, this is Seattle Sports Station. You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered by Kitsap Credit Union.
This hour of Jake and Stacy brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Let's take a look around the NFL. Drew Brees has retired from the booth of NBC, but maybe not. Also, he's retired from football, but also maybe not, Jake, because
there were
speculations that Drew not only had left NBC, but maybe returning to football. Very weird. Drew Brees tweeted, "Despite speculation from media, the pesky media, about my future this fall, I'm currently undecided. I may work for NBC. I may play football again. I may focus on business and philanthropy. I may train for the pickleball tour, senior golf tour, coach my kids, or all of the above. I'll let you know." Saints head coach Dennis Allen, by the way, was asked about that. Like, hey, is Drew Brees coming back to play? He said, I haven't had any conversations with Drew, and also says he thinks the comment, that tweet, was made in jest.
Yeah, I believe that this is a situation where Drew Brees is really annoyed and frustrated that anything about his career is out there before he gets to reveal it himself. It just is very
Tom Brady moment.
It just is very reminiscent of that Tom Brady moment where Adam Schefter, you know, spoils Tom Brady's announcement of unretiring and Brady coming back and basically doing the same thing, being like, nothing's been decided yet. I'll let you know about my future. And it's like, well, Tom, we all know you're coming back now. And Drew Brees kind of being in the same situation. And I get it. You don't want to have an announcement or anything being leaked out there until you're fully ready to make that decision if you haven't made it already. But, you know, if Drew Brees comes out you know, a week later or a couple days later, and it's, yeah, I'm going to walk away from NBC. It's like, what's the point of this? Mm-hmm. Other than to, you know, gain attention or, you know, I just truly don't understand just being like, hey, this is out sooner than I wanted it to be. But yeah, this is what's going to happen.
Tom Brady's very brief retirement continues to be one of the weirdest things.
It is.
It's just weird. And like Adam Schefter announcing it, that he was retiring, people getting upset about it, Brady presumably being like, I'll announce it when I'm ready, and then announcing it that he's retiring was just interesting, especially since Adam Schefter has broken plenty of news before about people retirement and people retiring. I get that it's Tom Brady and people were like, you should respect him doing it on his own time. But also, if you're an insider and you're sitting on that information, you're probably very tempted to report it.
Yeah. I mean, it's his job.
Yeah.
It's his job. I mean, there's a
very weird meeting of what someone in business does and what someone as a fan does.
Correct. But I also think that, look, people have jobs to do, right? And if they do that before you're ready, like, sorry, you just didn't keep that sealed up tight enough. And so I am going to be curious about what Drew Brees ends up deciding to do. And I'm honestly a little surprised that he's walking away. If he does end up deciding to do that, that he walks away after a year being in the studio. And I'm obviously not sure as to why he feels like he wants to step away from NBC, because he was going to be given incredible opportunities, right? In terms of, you know, opportunities in the booth, opportunities in studio, and getting paid pretty well for doing so. So, or maybe this is one of those things where he saw Tom Brady's contract, Stacey, and was like, yeah, I want to renegotiate my deal. And NBC was like, oh, sorry, we've got you on the contract that we have you on already. I don't know. I don't know what that process is like for him and his family, but I do know that his family means an awful lot to him, and getting to spend time with them and be there for them is priority number one.
We'll stay in the Southeast for this one. Do you guys remember when Ryan Tannehill had a press conference, was asked about the Titans drafting Malik Davis? Hey, what are you going to do to help Davis? And he basically said, it's not my job to mentor someone. Now, in full context, his answer basically sounded more like, you know, Davis is grown.
You mean it's Willis?
Willis. That Willis is grown, and like, it's not my job for Willis, you know, to like become the guy for him.
Right.
Willis was asked about it and said of Tannehill's comments, it was never anything negative. Ryan's a good dude. Everything is cool. Combining words here. He had us over to the house the other day and gave us a little bit of game regarding what comes with this process.
So, long story short, how Ryan Tannehill took the question of being a mentor versus how it was being asked is completely different, right? Ryan Tannehill, Stacey, took the comment of, are you going to be a mentor to Malik Willis? And he took that as, hey, you're just there keeping, you know, basically the job of the starting quarterback warm for Malik Willis. And Ryan Tannehill's like, no, my job is to be the starting quarterback of this team, right, and to help this team win games. My job is not to mentor Malik Willis and help him take my job. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to, you know, help him if he has questions. I just think Ryan Tannehill did a bad job presenting his answer. I think he was annoyed in the moment and said, no, I'm not going to be a mentor to this kid. And he didn't say it in a bad way, but I think that that's more of what his approach was versus his actions, as Malik Willis is saying. Hey, he had us over to his house. He's helping us, you know, prepare for what it's going to be like at rookie minicamp. He's helping me, you know, in terms of, you know, understanding the playbook and all that. That is being a good teammate. That is a form of mentorship and leadership. I think Ryan Tannehill took exception to the term mentor as, my job is going
to
be
moving aside to prop this person up.
Correct. I am giving up my job, and I'm not going to be the starting quarterback after this season. It's Malik Willis's job after this point, and I take exception to that. I just think the whole delivery of that wasn't good by Ryan Tannehill, but obviously his actions are better than what his response was to that reporter.
ESPN's latest power rankings, post-draft power rankings, has the Seahawks at 27. Mm. Brady Henderson, friend of the show, ESPN Seahawks reporter, says that Geno Smith and Drew Lock, he lists as the two players who benefited the most post-draft. I think we all know why, because the Seahawks didn't end up taking a quarterback.
Yeah, and honestly, I can't argue with him. I particularly said Cody Barton, but I get why Brady Henderson would say the quarterback, because when you're looking at Geno Smith and Drew Lock, there's nobody that's going to be in their way in the competition that is currently going on. You add somebody in from the draft, depending on where you drafted that player, and now you've added another legitimate competitor, right? The difference here being is that there is not a definitive answer long-term as to where these guys fit, right? The Seahawks aren't saying that Drew Lock and Geno Smith or Jacob Eason, for that matter, are going to be our future. They're going to be the guys for this year. After that, there's no commitment, right? And that is very clear in terms of the messaging, in terms of the outline as to how you build an elite level roster, and everybody's eyeing what they're going to do at the position of 2023. So as Brady Henderson saying, look, Drew Lock, Geno Smith, Jacob Eason, you're going to get your shot. You're going to get your opportunity. We'll see what you do with it. But most likely the plan is to, you know, find the next option after this season, unless they, you know, run away with the opportunity that's given.
All right, Friday, May 27th is 90s night for the Mariners. The first 10,000 fans will receive a Mariners neon pink hat. Get your tickets now to watch the M's take on the Astros at mariners.com/tickets. Again, that's Friday, May 27th, 90s night. I wanted to get back to a conversation we had earlier. What are the mile markers of how the Russell Wilson trade will be judged? More importantly, what things are we using to judge this trade now that we know week one is going to be an interesting showdown? That's next.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studio, this is Seattle Sports Station. You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered by Kitsap Credit Union.
Jake, I wanted to return to a conversation we had earlier about how you measure the success of the Russell Wilson trade. This conversation started because in week one, you're going to be taking on the Denver Broncos. So I think for a lot of people, a win over Denver would mean you won the trade. And while I understand why people would think that, I would argue very much that that does not say anything about whether or not you won the trade. I think there are a number of other factors that instead tell that story. So I'm just like anticipating that people are going to say that, you know, good thing we got rid of Russ. And it's like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
If you beat the Broncos, that's awesome. That's genuinely really awesome, especially because they're a pretty good team. But more importantly, if we're talking about other measures, how's Charles Cross?
Yeah.
How does he turn out? Do you find your quarterback of the future? You know, what happens with the production you get from other draft picks? You talked about Boye Mafe. Can you successfully reproduce the defense that you want to do, right? There's mm-hmm. other things where you look at it and you say, if Seattle's able to do blank, trading Russell Wilson was more than worth it.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, we get caught up in winning and losing, right? Obviously, it's the, okay, if Russell doesn't do well and the Broncos stink, like, that's great for our draft capital and everything else. There's reasons to have incentive to watch them fail,
mm-hmm.
but also they could succeed and you could succeed. So I'm more focused on, for the Seahawks, what has to happen for that trade to pay off and to be worth it. Those are certainly factors, don't get me wrong, but like you mentioned the draft capital. I look at the players that the Broncos got, or the Seahawks got back from the Broncos, Drew Lock, Noah Fant, Shelby Harris, and I'm not really looking at those three guys and saying, and maybe I'm looking at it wrong, and saying that they determine whether or not that trade is successful, because I don't see them being long-term answers for this organization.
I look at the draft picks they make with the picks they make with the picks they got in return.
Yeah, and that's not to say that Noah Fant, Drew Lock, or Shelby Harris can't contribute positively to this team for a year or two, but honestly, we're talking about long-term, sustained success, elite roster. You're looking at the draft picks.
Yeah.
Charles Cross, All-Pro. Boye Mafe, what does he become? Ken Walker. Abe Lucas, like what you do with your draft picks are going to greatly determine how this trade is looked at and how it's graded upon. Not to mention the fact that you have 2023 as well, where you're sitting there and you have two first, two second round picks. You've got a great opportunity to totally rebuild this team and restock it with great talent. That to me is what I'm looking at over the next couple years as to how this is going to go. Now, there's other factors to that as well in terms of, okay, how quickly can the Seahawks get back to the playoffs, and what type of success do the Denver Broncos have? If Russell Wilson's able to get the team to an AFC championship game, or he's able to get them to the Super Bowl, obviously you're going to feel some type of way about it if you're a Seattle Seahawks fan.
Well, especially if you have their first round pick.
Yes, and
it's
obviously
it vested interest in the Broncos being bad.
It lessens the value of that first round pick. There's no question about that. But those are things that I'm going to be looking at when you evaluate the long-term success of this trade. Week one, emotionally, yeah, you want to win the game, but does it mean that you won the trade because you won in week one? What about at the end of the season? What if the Broncos are ultra successful finishing the season strong and you're sputtering and it doesn't look good for you? Does week one matter at that point? No, but emotionally, it feels really good. So I think that there are clear indicators of what matters for this organization. And I think you pointed out very, very clearly in our show prep, and I 100% agree with you, what the most important indicator is going to be outside of the initial draft capital that you're going to get. It is also what you could do to really set this team up for success, which will probably happen next year, or at least they will attempt to do so next year.
Yeah, I think the single biggest thing you could do is get your quarterback of the future. But it also is something where if Drew Lock fails miserably,
mm-hmm.
I don't consider this trade a loss or lopsided because of that. It's more about the guy that you find. If Seattle can, because again, Seattle's going to get draft capital and good players from all over the place that have nothing to do with the Russell Wilson trade. If specifically with the Russell Wilson trade, where whatever your feelings about Russell Wilson, if you don't think he's a franchise quarterback, if you think he's horrible, that's on you. I don't agree with you, but you got rid of a guy that many other teams would not get rid of. I understand why you did it. I understand the financial restraints that someone like that gave you, and I understand the philosophical restraints someone like that gave you.
Mm-hmm.
Completely understand. If you want to make it pay off, the resources you got in return for that are what needs to pay off. Not just like you need to be a contender, but like you're a contender in part because you use the two first rounders that you then had as a result of that trade in 2023 to trade up and get your quarterback, and then you were able to win on a rookie deal. I also think
yeah.
that it is so much more important that you find your quarterback, because if Noah Fant is great, and if Shelby Harris is great, Chris is great, right? Or if Cross is great, then if all of that works out, that's fantastic, but you need the quarterback. And that's where it just becomes
right.
a difference in how you see a team winning. I personally think that it is very difficult to win a Super Bowl without having a great quarterback.
It's very true. And you got to have a great quarterback that can win you games at the end. And for Pete Carroll, the thing that I'm going to be very fascinated about, to be quite honest with you, is to watch this style of trying to win games, which is by elite defense and running game, keep things close. And when you're in those close games, Stacey, you know what determines winning and losing most times, more often than not in the NFL when you're in close games, is the have and have nots of who has a quarterback and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's genuinely typical of how you can look at, all right, if you're in a close ball game, what quarterback do you have? And I'm going to tell you who's going to win. Like, that's genuinely how this league works. And that is the type of game that Pete Carroll coaches towards, right? He wants to keep things close. He wants to keep things, you know, to the fourth quarter so that you're in range to be able to go win the game, right? And you're either going to go win the game or you're going to, you know, hold on and be able to come up with that 2-minute stop to win the game. And I think that is going to be extremely tough. And that's going to be a challenge that Drew Lock and Geno Smith are going to have to really step up their game. It's not just being able to manage the game. It is also when the game is close and you're in crunch time and you've got the ball and you've got to drive the team down in 2 minutes, can you do that on a consistent basis? For 10 years, Russell Wilson's been one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL in doing that. You do not have that type of player under center now, and how is that going to work out for you? I'm going to be genuinely curious about that because, you know, as you talk about needing a quarterback, you need to have a quarterback that can do that for you so that it really completes everything that Pete Carroll wants to do and how he wants to win football games.
All right, lineups are out. Let's take a look ahead at this Toronto series with Daniel Kramer of MLB.com. That's next.